I think it's actually the most important thing for a therapist to be a good therapist, whatever that means. But I actually used to joke with people, I don't pay my therapist for the hour I spend with him. I pay him for the 20 years of work he's done on himself so he can sit with me in a non-judgmental, compassionate way. It's all the work we do on ourselves that allows us to be non-judgmental, allows us to not have an agenda. It allows us to see people in their best light. It allows us to hold people, to understand the limits of our control. And to allow for self-determination, even when it's hard for us to experience our own pain when people make decisions that are hard and be able to say things truthfully without an agenda, right? Like, I think that's what makes a good therapist is I can say the thing and not necessarily have an agenda, right? I'm going to be honest, but I also don't have control. And I have to find that in myself.
Welcome to Deconstructing Therapy, transforming therapy and the therapists who lead it. Let's deep dive into conversations, reshaping therapy into a powerful tool for healing, liberation, and systemic change. Join us as we challenge the status quo, reimagine care, and celebrate therapists breaking barriers. Let's transform therapy together.
I'm so excited to have Nalini Kalamar on the show today. Nalini is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She is a multilingual, multicultural, and pansexual therapist dedicated to helping individuals, couples, and families navigate complex trauma, conflict, and identity exploration. With extensive experience in community mental health, substance use treatment, and attachment-based therapy, Nalini takes a relational and experiential approach to healing, grounded in self-acceptance and self-compassion. She is trained in emotionally focused therapy, EMDR, sensory motor psychotherapy, and mindfulness-based substance use counseling, and has trained many therapists in multi-systemic approaches to family and couples work, specifically how to integrate a multicultural lens with attachment-based emotionally focused therapy. She creates spaces in therapy to support people in loving themselves and others better because she firmly believes we are wounded in relationship, we can also heal in relationship.
It's so good to be invited here. Thank you so much.
Of course. I recently actually just met Nalini at a training that she was doing for EFT, emotionally focused therapy, and it was about the worldview. You know, we always talk about holding all the truths and everybody's perspective and being able to hold the context in a different way, and I thought that was very beautiful. And then seeing another South Asian in this field, I'm like, yes, I have to get to know every South Asian here because there's very few. But it was just a beautiful training and opened my eyes to a lot of different things. And I was actually very touched by the way you were non-pathologizing. I remember talking about that with somebody else afterwards too. We always say we don't want to judge anybody. We don't want to pathologize anybody. EFT, our training and our model is very non-pathologizing. We don't diagnose people. We don't see people in context. But oftentimes we kind of stop there and then say, well, we are going to judge your mom for what she's doing. We're going to put a little label on your partner, or we're going to put everything else in these little boxes. And just the open-mindedness that you are walking into, that was very refreshing for me, of how you see everybody in context.
Thank you. I wish I did, but like, I definitely try to do that in my therapeutic work. I do think it's something that we often forget, that we're not always helping our clients when we agree with how they see everyone in the world. Sometimes it actually causes pain for them to be mad at their parents, and maybe mad is okay for a bit, but maybe it's not the end game.
Yeah. And it's a balancing act. You know, you want to validate their perspective and their reality, but also help them see the nuance and things. Do you have a different multicultural lens when it comes to that? Like, when you're dealing with, say, somebody who is having issues, an adult child having issues with their parents, and they're coming from the dominant culture versus coming from a different culture, well, how do you handle that differently? How would you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good question. It kind of depends on, I think that everyone has their sort of bicultural experience, and we're adapting multiple cultures, and we're trying to figure out where our balance is in any one place. So it does depend on the client in front of me or the clients in front of me. But for the most part, when I work with adults who are multicultural, I have found that if I try to like acknowledge the impact of their parents on them, sometimes I'll just get dismissal and just know it wasn't that bad or it wasn't whatever. And I realize what if I can let the parents off the hook a little bit by talking about like what was going on for their parents, and that must have been so hard, and wow, I can see like all that your parents were going through. And then they can say, yeah, you know what? My parents did go through a lot. It was really hard for them. And then I can say, and that must have been really hard for you too, that this was all going on for your parents. So I found that if I could find a sort of intergenerational way to talk about the way things get passed down, I could get the client to actually say, yeah, that was really hard for me. That was really bad. that my parents couldn't, yada, yada, because they were impacted by this. And I was like, oh, this is something they don't teach you, right? In such an individualistic culture, we're like, well, your experience is the most important experience, right? But when you grow up in a country that's so different from you and you're always trying to defend like the way your family does things anyway, I grew up in a very white area, the idea of someone directly coming at your parents might feel bad, you know, even if it's in my best, what they think is my best interest. And so I found that like, because I could see this would regularly work, I would sort of start with that, like talking about how immigration impacted their family or how did, you know, the lineage of trauma or impact their parents, right?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's kind of that holding the both truths too, because that's something I get stuck on too. I think in the way we're trained a lot of times, it's like making that story very two-dimensional of how they grew up so that you can understand your client better and how they were harmed and what the needs they didn't get met. And you're kind of dehumanizing their history a little bit. So I love how you can do both. You can say, yeah, your parents had it hard, but that doesn't excuse the fact that you also had it hard because of their struggles.
You know, Alethea, Ryan Zashko was talking to Hannah Levinson, who did the Deliberate Practice book for EFT. She and I were talking and I said, you know, part of the challenge is that with the EFT and Deliberate Practice, we have to like simplify things. But when we simplify things too much, we miss who people really are. And like, if we really want to think about what multicultural sensibility is, it's actually complexifying people, which is very at odds with the learning process, which is trying to simplify so we can gather. And so this trade-off, I think, is really hard in learning. And in fact, Sue Johnson would always say, like, if it's too complicated, people won't be able to grasp it. That was what she said to me when we were talking about our theory to her. She said, well, you know, it's not that you're wrong. All these things are true. However, if you add all these things to the theory, it's going to be too hard to learn. And so that question of like pedagogy versus reality, I think is kind of what you're talking about, right? Like if we put people too much in a box, then we might be missing really important things about their experience.
But you're right. I guess when you're learning, you need to be able to simplify it. So maybe everybody needs to go through that evolution. You have to learn the attachment history and understand it. But we're often like trying to piece together the puzzle ourselves when we're with a client, and then we can simplify it in that effort.
I was going to say, although I've never been able to simplify it because I always have held these things in my mind. So I always buck against those like ideas that like, oh, we have to simplify it, because even if you simplify it, I understand these things are going on. It doesn't actually simplify in my mind. So who are we simplifying it for?
So it never landed with you.
Not that part, not the simplifying part. Yeah. And I can speak more about that a little bit. And part of it is like what I said, my family was so different than the other families. When I was learning about family therapy, some of the models didn't even make sense. So they didn't talk about any of like the isms, any outside influences that might impact families, like low income or food scarcity might impact families or stress levels. Didn't talk about how racism impacts families or the stress of that, or how living in a city that's impacted by community violence might impact, you know, the adolescent parent relationship. Like these things were just not even addressed in any of the theories I learned. In some ways, simplifying makes sense, but then who are we teaching for and about, and what are we missing about? Like what I think is the majority of the population is impacted by things, external situations that are outside of their control, or whether that's based on their social location or, you know, other issues impacted by the system.
So how did you handle that when you were learning? So when you were learning and it was simplified and people really didn't take in person in context, did you just adjust that in your brain? Did you try to initially do it that way? What was this process like for you?
I think this is a really good question. I haven't really thought about too much, but I think some of it had to do with like the way that I learned to compartmentalize as a kid around race. And some of this is because of privilege as a South Asian person. I have more ability to do that. A lot of times Latino, Black people, they can't just compartmentalize. They're never going to be white enough. We're not either, but we have more ability to move up in certain ways. Yeah, for sure. So I think I just like pushed aside cultural stuff and like did the thing that I was supposed to do. And so when I was learning, I did that. I pushed aside the cultural stuff and put it in the container over here. And I learned these things and I was really excited about family therapy. And it wasn't until later I realized like, oh, I had kind of shoved all this stuff aside. And I need to figure out how to put it back, because a lot of the people I'm sitting with, this is a really important part of their reality too. But it wasn't until later I was like, oh, wow, I have such an intense capacity to compartmentalize like who I really am from like what society expects of me.
Can you speak to that a little bit about, you know, and I, as a South Asian, I know it's in my bones that we've code shift and we do it all the time and it's just so natural. And once you realize that you're doing it and you kind of, you know, on that journey to be more authentic, you realize how more and more how much you've been doing it. But what was that evolution for you? When did that start hitting you? It's like, wow, I really compartmentalized.
Yeah, I've kind of an interesting experience. I grew up in Chicago. Both my parents are South Asian. They both came here in their 20s after the civil rights movement allowed for more people to come in, especially with visas, H-1 visas. So my parents came here and my sister and I were born here and my brother was born in India. But we were all sort of raised here in different cities, but I was born in Chicago. And by the time I was born, both my parents were professional. My mom was a doctor. My dad was a chemical engineer. So by the time I was born, I was the youngest. My mom was sort of more in her career. And so they ended up hiring someone to live with us who was a Mexican, older Mexican woman from Michoacan. And she lived with us on and off for 10 years. She didn't have children of her own or family. So at some point when we no longer needed her, we just were like, hey, come live with us. But as a result of that, like I was really raised with very strong Mexican cultural values and roots, as well as South Asian. I grew up speaking Spanish. I didn't speak English till I was 5. Spanish was actually my first language. And so I think I have such a weird perspective because I grew up in a family where like there were multiple languages being spoken. Maybe not everyone spoke every language. I spent a lot of time translating. I think I grew up in I'm South Asian, and for sure, all of the things with South Asian experience and cultural things, we had our little like cultural community we would hang out with, and all those kids were like cousins to me. You know everything about their life, and you're compared to them, so they feel like family. But I also had this other experience that was very different from anyone else that I knew.
What was school like? Was school...
School was terrible, honestly. I was in a mostly white neighborhood, kind of like middle-class white neighborhood, and I was bullied, especially by, like, just by everybody, really. Bullied for being brown, bullied for not being Christian, bullied for being too hairy, too dark, too whatever. Was really painful for me for a lot of my elementary school, and I didn't sort of get out of that until high school.
And you were just stepping into so many worlds, right? So it's just when you came home, I think with most of us too, we come home and then it's a whole other, we're speaking a different language, we're eating different foods, our mannerisms, everything changes. And you were doing it on two different levels. So what was your relationship like with your parents? Did you feel more culturally different from them being the youngest?
I felt very close to Nana. I mean, she was like the one that I would go to. She left around when I was 6 and came back when I was 8. And so like I definitely experienced her. I don't have memory of her leaving. So I'm like, oh, I had intense abandonment trauma. And then I don't have any memory, right? Or of her coming back. And so it's like, oh, I was. If you look at photos, I was very attached to her. And I just remember feeling so comforted by her. You know, when my oldest was born, she was living in hospice and we went to go visit and she was so tickled that I speak Spanish to my children. And like he was speaking to her in Spanish. And, you know, it's like very sweet. My mom, I longed to have a connection with my mom. But my mom was like kind of difficult to connect to in some ways. She was like very vibrant, very alive, very funny, very charming. But she also was very overwhelmed and was not able to cope with a lot of the traumas that she'd experienced. And certainly some of the experiences of coming here and being totally separated from her family or experiencing sexism. Like she experienced a lot of sexism, especially in her career, and probably like a combination of sexism, racism, being like a brown woman who's a doctor. And she didn't cope with that super well. It definitely landed on us, you know.
And you just do it so beautifully where you can hold both of, you really can feel that empathy for your mom. She was overwhelmed and she wasn't able to cope well, but sexism, all the stuff, like I can feel the empathy that you're feeling for her. And then also that empathy that you're feeling for yourself of like, I didn't get my needs met because she didn't have the capacity.
But I longed for that with her. And sometimes I had it and sometimes I didn't. And so that inconsistency, I think, was something I didn't really realize until I was older. I think I was, again, good at compartmentalizing, but eventually it always hits you. So
do you think that's part of what led you into the work?
I think so. Because the longing is about hope that things could be different, right? If I didn't have longing, I would have turned off part of myself in a way. So yeah, I think it's true. I do. I'm one of those people who is a good family therapist because I'm always hopeful. And you know, I'm always going to hold that people are doing their best and that they're trying to do better.
So when did you know you wanted to be a therapist? Was it always a therapist, your first profession?
I grew up in a very science-y family. So I actually went to a math and science academy and I went there. And I studied math and science. I was not really into human behavior at the time, although I was like,
you're South Asian and they pushed math and science? Really?
That's a shocker. I don't feel like they pushed it. I definitely feel like I had like genuine interest in it.
Okay.
And I found it to be interesting and engaging and fun. And I was also like good at it. I found like what I really liked about it is most of the time there was like a right answer. There was some kind of certainty that I could fall back on that I think I really liked, and I needed something like that, especially because I grew up in a household that was kind of chaotic. But I liked the certainty of it, you know, mm-hmm. whereas when you're talking about these other professions, whether it's yeah. writing or psychology, there's no right answer. We're all like sort of approximating.
Yes, that's so true. There's a lot of safety in that certainty of, okay, there's an answer, a clear-cut one. Okay.
But I actually studied chemical engineering and biological sciences. I went to Stanford and had a double major in very sciencey stuff.
How did you make that shift?
I enjoyed it a lot. But I also, like, when my junior year, I did an internship and I loved the people I was working with, but I could not really do the work because it was very isolative. Like, I would be working a lot alone. And I thought, this is not going to be sustainable for me. I'm too social. I want to connect with people and it's not going to work. And so that's when I actually went into sales and marketing for a long time. But if I would say like what was really profound, at least at that point, that really did inform later, maybe not at the time, mm-hmm. the profession I wanted to have, is I had a pretty intense mental health episode during my junior and senior years. And so you see like my grades are like this and then they go like this. Like it's so extreme, you know, and I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know why I felt that way. I just couldn't really function going to classes and things like that. And so that I think is really part of what sort of became a pattern in my life, to have these really intense episodes where I would just crash. And so that, but I didn't know it at the time and I didn't really understand what it was about. I tried to do my best, you know, a lot of shame, couldn't tell my family.
You had to hide that you weren't doing well on top of everything else. Did you have that typical kind of South Asian pressure to focus on your studies and all that?
Sure. And to go to medical school and all that. And
right. So if you're not smart, if you're not doing well in school, it goes very deep to that internal shame.
I didn't even tell my parents that I stopped out of school because I couldn't graduate. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell my family because in my mind, I was like, I don't want to hear it. I can't hear about it. Yeah. I already feel so crappy. I cannot already hear about it again.
And if you heard about it, it would just make it more real.
I can like feel suicidal, like feel so terrible inside that they like would see me that way, or that I was a failure, that I was stupid, that I was whatever it is, that I was failing them. I was not valuing the work that they had done to have me where I am. It's just kind of too much disappointment and defeat, and I couldn't tolerate it at the time, especially because I was actually depressed and ashamed too.
You were falling apart. You couldn't handle it. And then on top of it, okay, now I have to worry about honoring my parents. I got to worry about hiding this and take the energy that you probably didn't even have to keep it from them. Did you have support system?
Oh, no, I had nobody, really. I mean, I had some friends, but I couldn't talk about what was going on with me to them.
And did you have experience growing up where you were able to fall apart, or that, you know, the places where you're not feeling like you are getting it right and a failure? Did you have like no lived experience of sharing that with people?
I did not experience that in my life. Actually, I was very high achieving. I was able to be pretty decent in everything I did. I was never going to be the best, but I was pretty close to like top 5, top 10%. Also, I grew up in a family where like my sister, we all absorbed the stress of my parents differently. And my parents, there was a lot of substance use. There was physical violence in our family. There was a lot of anger, rage. My mom had really intense mood swings, especially when drinking. And so there was a lot of stuff going on in the family, a lot of sort of everyone going their separate ways to manage. And my sister was the one who sort of like fell apart. And so I was the one who was never going to fall apart. And my brother was the one who was never going to be at home. And so we all managed that stress differently. So I was the one who was like, going to do all the things. I'm going to be the one who never, it's like, I don't want to be under the radar. I want to get that approval.
And then it caught up with you. So how did you get out of that? How did you kind of shift gears?
I ended up, like I said, I ended up getting married and being like, okay, this is how I'm going to be my own person. And I'm going to just like separate a little bit. I ended up going back to school and graduating, but I mostly just went a different way. I did some sales marketing, also with a stable mom, which by the way was very disappointing to my family. Very, very disappointing to my family. I remember talking to my uncle like even a few years ago, and he said, I was so disappointed in you because I thought you had so much potential. And I thought, well, I guess my life is over. you know, I didn't say that because I actually thought it was very courageous for him to say this thing that he had been feeling. And I feel really close to him and admire him a lot. And I could tolerate that at that age when I finally heard it.
Did you have any of that internalized for yourself from being a stay-at-home mom?
I don't think I feel like I have shame about being a stay-at-home mom, but I do have sort of the reality of like what it's like to have 10 years of your life. Like I'm 10 years behind in my career than most people. That is a reality. I don't know if I feel shame about it, but there is a sense of like, I'm not where I want to be. I don't feel like I'm bad, but it is just something that is real. A lot of failure messages, a lot of like how you should be, how you should present, you should be the best, you know, always a sense of like presenting our family as good and perfect, right, while inside everything was like really chaotic and lonely and scary. And
so how did you adjust to that? Did you just kind of keep putting that mask on? And then if stuff was falling apart, you would just hide it better and better?
As a kid, I think I just like really effectively compartmentalized. I would compartmentalize the parts of my mom that were like violent and scary, really focus on these parts of her that were lovely and beautiful and wanting to be like her. I really idolized my mom in really a lot of ways. She was a beautiful, smart, engaging, charming person who could convince people of anything. She's probably the best salesperson I've ever known. She was a doctor, but you know, she could ask someone to do her a favor and then they would thank her for letting them help. It was like, without. So she had an art of like making people feel, I don't know, special. Yeah, I definitely drifted towards her. Like there's a lot of like me wanting to be close to her, and definitely some sort of like when she was getting worse in her drinking or worse in her pain, and like her own remorse as she got older, her life wasn't what she wanted. I would be the one who would be there when she would tell me about all her misery and you know, and I was like, I definitely wanted to be there for her. I was close. I felt close. I loved her.
And then what about your stuff? What did you do with your stuff?
I didn't even realize it existed. I had such good dissociation going on. I mean, that was, dissociation probably helped me survive, really. Just like ignoring these other parts and not making them real. I had another sort of really intense hit of depression postpartum that lasted about 5 years. Just did what I could to sort of function and be there for my child, but was like really, really struggling inside. That was really hard. That's when I actually started to use substances to numb all the feelings, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was also a time where both my parents passed away during the first 5 years of my child's really, my child's like my oldest is 5. And my parents passed away when he was like 4 and 5 and a half. And so all that was going on. I was also going through a separation. And so I understand now that a lot of my depression is just being so overwhelmed by everything. Yeah. I can't process it. And then so my body just shuts everything down.
And no wonder you are able to hold context for people so well, because you swam in a lot of context that was impacting you. So you know the real life of it. Sounds like you have compassion for those parts too that had to do the best they could. What kind of got you out of it? How did you make that shift? Was there any gifts that you got from being depressed and kind of being more inward?
I think there's a lot of gifts I have received from being profoundly depressed. There's a lot of gifts I've received from struggling with substance use, almost dying. Like, I definitely feel grateful. I had a friend who I had in college who was like one of my best friends, and she saw me and she just looked at me. She said, "What happened? You're like, you look like a shell of yourself." And that was like so powerful for me, because I think that was the first time someone had said it and seen it and cared enough to say anything. And I think about like moment, really, that's true for us as therapists, right? Like, we're seeing the thing nobody wants to say, and we're seeing it because we care, and we're saying it because we care. And that really changed everything for me. She invited me to like a group healing, and I did that. And then she said, "There's this other thing that you might really like. It's a peer counseling program. Like, you can do it. It'll help you get emotional support, and also like you'll build community, which is what you really need." And that changed my life.
I mean, you were holding on to it alone for so long. Is that when you kind of decided to become counselor or healer? Like, was...
Yeah, a lot of things happened sort of all at once at that stage. So going into that program, I had been so demoralized and defeated. I felt like I couldn't apply for jobs. I felt like I had no worth. I was useless, had nothing to offer. I had no sense that anyone would hire me. But then through this program I got, I was inspired and helped to apply to grad school, because I was like, I really can do this counseling thing. I actually enjoy it, and I'm actually not bad at it. Like, it's nice. I went back to school to become a therapist, and sort of around the same time, my substance use escalated, and I started to end up sort of like, again, compartmentalizing, because I have all this time where I'm functioning really well. And then I would binge really intensely on weekends and like have this separation. At some point, the separation wasn't so clean, but I was always still going to work and whatever, right? Doing the thing I had to do. Again, I grew up in that. So that was like not unfamiliar to me, like sort of parroting things I had seen without knowing it. And then at some point, I like my use got to such a dangerous level that I actually was like, I'm going to die if I keep doing this. And I ended up I went into treatment. And that, again, was a moment, huge moment for me. And, you know, one of the questions you had asked me even coming in here was like, what are the things that influence you as a therapist? So some of the things that influence me are the things I've talked about, right? Growing up in a family that's really struggling, you know, I'll just say it to anybody, but you like really cannot manage. Also being culturally different and how that impacted me and the experiences of racism, experiences of aloneness and isolation because of that. The other thing in my substance use, I think I had so much shame. Everybody has so much shame around using. And one of the most instrumental like interventions I've ever seen, and I swear it's probably the best intervention I've ever received from any counselor, therapist, otherwise, her name was Shar, and she was a substance use counselor at this place that I was getting help. We were doing an exercise and I started to get mad. Basically, it was the exercise was like, what's your part in it? And they look at like all these childhood dynamics and they're like, what was your part in it? I was like, what do you mean, what was my part in it? Like, nothing was my part in it. Like, this was not my thing. What are you talking about? I was a child. And then she said, your part in it was that you were there. And it just like was so profound to me because it was like, you couldn't help being there, but that was the only thing you could contribute. And it helped me see the ways that I was putting myself in situations that were dangerous or chaotic as an adult. And that I had choices to be there or not. As a kid, I didn't. But as an adult, I was making choices. And that discrepancy was so important to me because it was like, how does this stuff play out now? And it just helped me see how trauma shows up in the present, right? We recreate these patterns and don't always know why.
We're just, our nervous systems are so used to that chaos. We just find it. Yeah.
And then the other thing she said that also like blew me away was she said, I'm so glad that you found drinking. And I was like, what? Because I was mired in shame and I was in treatment. So what do you mean? She said, because you would have killed yourself if you didn't. And that felt so true. So emotional for me even when I say it now. Yeah. But part of it is that like, I feel really intensely how much judgment people have of people who use substances, like in general. And I work with clients who use substances. So I know there's so much shame and there's something so loving about what she said. That was true.
Yeah. Are you able to take that in fully?
Like, I sobbed. I felt so seen. Like, I took it fully in. You know, it was the truest thing I've ever said to me. And I've used that with people. Yeah. And it just, like, it disarms them and they start sobbing. Because we hold so much shame about bad ways we cope with pain. And this was one of those bad ways I was coping with pain. And then we have so much shame for feeling pain. So we're just stuck as humans. And so for me, that really showed me that like everything, no matter how bad it is, has a function. And we're always doing the best we can with the resources we have. And that has shaped how I see therapy. Like that's how I think that's why I'm such a good family therapist is I really believe that. I know that they're doing their best with the resources they have and the way that they're coping with the pain that they're feeling about the situation. So those are like big pieces that really like impacted me, that peer counseling program. Being seen by my friends, the multicultural experiences I had, loneliness, substance use, and then some of the ways that people have really loved me.
There's so much power in being loved in places where you feel shame. And you're right. Like substance abuse is one of those things that even in our field, there's like all the shame added to it and not understanding. And it is powerful. You saved yourself, though.
I was talking to a mentor of mine who's a sensory motor psychotherapist trainer. I said to her, we need to write an article about how dissociation actually saves people's lives. Because there's so much stuff in the field about shame and getting people to stop dissociating and all this is like the way that we look at it is not helpful to people who struggle or need that dissociation.
I agree. I mean, I feel like I disassociated most of the time after I had kids too. And I still have a lot of shame around that. But it took years for my body to kind of get out of it. And there's a lot of shame to parents, like even in our field, like even when I look at mental health stuff and it's like, you got to be this type of parent. Oh, if you're doing this, you're having this kind of damage on your child. And I was a therapist. So it's like all of that stuff made it so much more pressure that I know all the ways I can mess them up. But you don't realize like, yeah, but what if when you're tired, what if when you don't have it? I know the right things to do. And I know how not being perfectly present all the time and attached perfectly to them is what's going to do it to them. That's not the problem, but people don't realize like we're human. Moms are just human.
Well, I think sometimes when we put such pressure on parents, it's like, what happens if you are perfect? what happens to your child if you are the perfect parent? They cannot manage anyone else in the world. They have experiences of managing disappointment. They don't have experiences of things not being done perfectly. They don't have experience for like someone who breaks down and has feelings. They don't have experience for someone who's like has a bad day. So how are they going to function in the world? So that's how I comfort myself.
I mean, that's why the therapists that have gone through the most are like really good therapists, because we can connect to those feelings and hold space for other people who've had those feelings. So you were still a counselor, and then you were kind of like falling apart in the weekends. When did it start integrating more?
There were people who knew I was falling apart, right? Like my ex knew I was falling apart. Probably my child knew I was falling apart. There were people who knew, maybe some really close friends. But for the most part, the outside world, like I was still getting straight A's in school. I was still going to my practicum, seeing clients, not missing a day. That's something I learned, right? Things started to integrate after I went to treatment, but not immediately. So I also have experiences with like having a criminal record and the way that impacts you, mm-hmm. your profession. I had a 3-year delay in getting licensed. They didn't want to give me an associate's number. Like, and I was still showing up to work every day, still doing really good work. The recommendations I got from my supervisors was really great. But things really started to integrate during that period of time where I was rejected. So for people who are like new to this field, basically you graduate. And then when you graduate, the BBS gives you an associate's number so you can continue to collect hours. Without the associate's number, you cannot collect hours to become licensed. So effectively, it stopped me in my process because they refused to give me an associate's number because of my past legal history. And I fought that for 3 years. But what I did learn, this is part of the consequence of losing trust. Like when you make choices that makes people lose trust in you, part of it is it takes time to rebuild. This is the wreckage. Like in substance use recovery, they talk about like, this is the wreckage. You have to deal with the wreckage. The wreckage of my past choices, what I was using, is this, that I don't get an associate's number with like everybody else. And then it started to integrate more because I was not using, and I was dealing with this, which was like the choices that I had made while I was using. And that's when things sort of started to come together. But things were not going to come together when I was still using in this compartmentalized way. So when I stopped using in that way, things sort of start to come together and start to integrate.
Okay, so it's like that fully awake and healed, more healed person was taking care of the consequences of the one that was substance abusing, and that started integrating you more.
And that too, like I think there's a part of me that tries to be like reality based. Mm-hmm. Like I can stay in things longer because I just can engage. And be like, this is just what's happening. It doesn't mean it's going to be this way forever. And I'm going to stay here. And I know it's bad, but I also know why I'm here. I made some choices to get here. And so I can hold that a little bit that can help me stay engaged.
Have you always been able to do that? Have that level of accountability? Even in like, that's rather, no, okay. That was some growth.
No, no.
Okay.
Most people who struggle with substances struggle with accountability.
Yeah.
Like, not all, but most in some areas of their life. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, nope, this is the consequences, so I'm going to stick this through. I'm not going to numb this out. I'm not going to blame somebody else for it.
Otherwise, I'm not going to have the life I want. Like, I wanted to be a therapist so badly by that point, and I had invested time and money in that career. And I was lucky, so lucky, and I tell this to people all the time, I was so lucky because I had the internal resources mm-hmm. and the external resources to manage this 3-year delay. A lot of people have just given up, which is also why we don't have enough diversity in the field. Yes. Like, if the board decides you can't, for whatever reason, sometimes people can't wait 3 years. They can't work two jobs or whatever and stay afloat. They don't have enough financial resources or internal resources. The only reason I'm a therapist today is because of that.
And that's true. That is why we don't have enough diversity too, because of a lot of barriers that we don't have the privileges to do. Well, I'm glad you're able to recognize your own strength and your accountability and your fight in it, and also like the external privileges with it. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you practice differently? Like, because you were still doing it, and I'm guessing you were still doing it pretty well. But what is the difference in when you were more integrated and you were not having those weekend falling apart? Like, how did that show up differently in the therapy room?
It's a hard question to answer because there's so many things that were going on in that time. The more integration for me emotionally was happening. But I was also learning to become a therapist. So there was a lot of learning and teaching that was going on. So it's hard to attribute, is the growth, is the change because of more integration or is the change because of both integration and all the learning? And so, yeah, because I had really great supervisors. My first placement was at a placement that had a lot of supervision. I had 3 units of supervision for maybe like 10 clients. So I had group supervision, 2 units of individual supervisions. I got a lot of guidance. feedback. We would record every session. I'd have supervisors pause and say, like, what were you thinking right here? What was going on inside? What do you hope that that intervention was going to do? What did it actually do? And like really breaking down like what therapy looks like, and how do you know whether an intervention is successful, right? So how do you start to understand yourself so you can actually catch yourself doing things that take people away from their experience? And so I was taught that way, which also started to help me learn myself better, because a lot of it was like that self-therapist work, understanding your own countertransference, that however we want to call it. While I was also in therapy, sometimes once or twice a week, definitely once a week, sometimes twice a week, with individual supervision. So like a lot of my, I think, reason that I was able to integrate and survive and heal so much was because of that, like just that level of constant inquiry.
Can you speak a little bit about how the benefits of doing that self-therapist work for people who are not familiar with it, and how, you know, I know we talk about a decent amount of EFT, but just bringing ourselves into the room.
I think it's actually the most important thing. I think it's the most important thing for a therapist to be a good therapist, whatever that means. But I actually used to joke with people, I don't pay my therapist for the hour I spend with him. This is what I have as therapist. Is it? I don't actually pay him for the hour I spend with him. I pay him for the 20 years of work he's done on himself so he can sit with me in a non-judgmental, compassionate way. Right? It's all the work we do on ourselves that allows us to be non-judgmental, allows us to not have an agenda. It allows us to see people in their best life. It allows us to hold people, to understand the limits of our control,
right?
And to allow for self-determination, even when it's hard for us to experience our own pain when people make decisions that are hard, and be able to say things truthfully without an agenda, right? Like, I think that's what makes a good therapist, is I can say the thing and not necessarily have an agenda, right? I'm going to be honest, but I also don't have control. And I have to find that in myself, that a lot of times therapists, like, it's my job to stop people from killing themselves. And like, it's not. If someone wants to take their life, they will. You cannot actually control that, right? But that comes with sitting with your own ability to be with things outside of your control, and like really understanding what is outside of my control. What is my obligation? What is the level of influence I can have? And where is the place where, like, can I be okay with that? Sitting with people who are struggling with life or death. I also think we do harm when we don't do that work. Like, I think especially when we're talking about difference, and this is what I often say in our trainings, is like, if you're feeling judgment about what somebody's doing, you don't notice it, you're going to cause harm. And a lot of times we feel judgment when people are different. Their values, the way that they decide to do things is different than us. And then when we impact that, especially if the difference has a power difference and we're on the upside, we're going to recreate patterns of oppression unconsciously. And so that can be really harmful. But if I understand myself and see like, oh, I'm doing that judgment thing, well, let me just take a step back and see like what is going on for me around this. What is it about this difference? And how can I see the client more accurately from their values, from their perspective, why this makes sense to them, then I can actually be more effective with them.
People can feel it when you're in that centered self, authentic person, and there's not like this other narrative behind the scenes going on. You can feel it. And I think that's the most powerful thing you can do as a therapist. So another thing that I think I talked about on my last podcast, that this is the best tool we have, right? Doing that self-therapist work, really being ourselves and pulling that out, and we practice it in our trainings. And so often, like, a dilemma that people in the global majority have is like, you need that. And then in the trainings, it's like, you're not really able to fully embody that if you're in a dominant culture where that in itself doesn't feel safe. So how have you navigated? Have you had that dilemma yourself?
For sure. I mean, and this is where it comes back to that like ability to compartmentalize I was talking about, because I worked at an agency that was mostly white. And I also worked at an agency that was like Black owned, mostly people of color that worked there. And the first thing I noticed, you asked me like, when did I start to notice this compartmentalization, is that I noticed I was different people at different places. But I didn't realize it until like I sort of had to reflect on it. I could be more myself, more relaxed, more like irreverent, whatever. I'm myself, I'm loud. I'm irreverent. I make like silly jokes. I like, you know, it's who I am. I swear a lot. I swear with clients who swear, because it like sometimes it makes them feel like you really get me. It's real. And so I feel like when I realized that I was such a different person there, that's what sort of hit for me. I didn't realize how much of me was impacted by this, right? But I was also really lucky, because in my cohort in school, we had a majority of people of color. So what happens when you have a majority of people of color is it decenters whiteness. So in my learning experience, I was able to have that. When I came to EFT, which was a very more white dominated theory, I found myself really struggling because I had two parts of me. Part that was really struggling, I did not see these parts of me or parts of my clients reflected. And then the part of me that could compartmentalize, which was like, this is a really great theory. This is amazing. It is all about relationships. It's all about love. It's all about attachment. Like, this is real. And I think that started to integrate when I met Jay, actually, on the diversity committee, because by then I was starting to have these conversations to start integrating it with my clients. I had a client who was trans, and they were coming to me and they were talking about their struggle with dissociation. I said, how do you think being trans might impact your experience of dissociation? And they said they had never had anyone ask. And I was like, oh, it feels like an important question when you have like an experience of your body that other people don't have, and vice versa, that might impact like your relationship to being in your body. And for that person, it didn't, but they were really excited that I asked the question. Kinds of things, I think, didn't really come to feeling comfortable doing it and integrating fully until I was starting to do that social justice work. I was being on like the diversity committees and speaking out and saying the things more publicly. Mm-hmm. And then I started to integrate it more in my practice.
And your journey and the way you're talking about is, I've heard that from almost every person of color. We're just so used to compartmentalizing and we expect it to be just white dominant, get what we need, some kind of knowledge, and then shift it to how we need to do it at home. And at some point, you just can't keep doing that. So I'm glad that you're able to do that, that you were finding that cohort and that you're such a powerful voice within our community.
I do think I was lucky. Again, I was like trained and supervised by in that other organization with people who were really experts at dealing with difference and naming privilege and the clients that they were working with versus where the supervisor, like her privilege was, and just naming, like, I don't know what it's like to live without food, like to live in food scarcity. I don't know. You're right. And I'm here and I can help. If you'll give me a chance, maybe I can help. And that sense of like humility that she taught me of just like, this is actually true and there's no fighting it. There's no minimizing it. And if you do, you're just going to lose trust. They feel it anyway.
Exactly.
Like, our class markers are all over us. That I think was really, I was really lucky because I had one place where I was just doing that like very white center, like even EFT, very like no culture involved. And then this other experience or cultural experiences and difference was like, you know, I was lucky to have that parallel training.
I love hearing your story. I mean, it's so multifaceted. I appreciate that, how much authenticity you're coming with today. If you had any kind of takeaways to give people kind of doing this work or struggling with that integration for themselves.
I think first, like, I definitely tell people I had a crooked path to where I got, you know, but eventually if you keep moving forward and you keep investing in yourself and you keep trying, you're going to find a place where they all come together. I've made a lot of mistakes and I've made a lot of mistakes with people I love. I've made a lot of mistakes with the legal system. I've made a lot of mistakes in the way that I've treated myself, 100% in the ways that I've treated myself, and that you can recover and you can learn to forgive yourself. You can learn to move forward. Your life isn't over because it didn't go the way that you wanted. It takes work, but you can have something different.
And I just, thinking back to you, we said earlier, you know, I'm just 10 years behind everybody else because of all this stuff. But I just see everything that you went through as so invaluable. If you had not gone through that and you kept progressing forward, you wouldn't be the therapist you are today. You wouldn't be able to see the complexity and the nuance in everybody in the way that you're seeing it. It's like, it's remarkable. So I think it was such part of your journey.
I also think I wouldn't have become a therapist. If I did not go through what I went through, I wouldn't have become a therapist.
Really such an honor to meet you. Anywhere people can find you, any resources you want to name out?
Absolutely. Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for having me here. It's been a delight having a conversation with you and just getting to be here to talk about my life has been an honor. So thank you to give me that venue to do so. In terms of like where you can find me, my name is really rare. So if you just put in my name in Google, you'll find my website. I'm the only Nalini Calamer in the world. My website is myfirstandlastname.com. NaliniCalamer.com. My email is Nalini@NaliniCalamer.com. You can also find me at EFT Lifeline, where my colleague partner, Jay Saifaran, and I run workshops, one of which is called Navigating the Rapids, Power, Culture, and Difference in EFT, where we talk about like multi-systemic attachment-based therapies. I definitely am open to consultation, supervision, and really just if you want to have these kinds of conversations, I'm pretty open to that too.
Thank you so much. And I'll include that stuff in the show notes. Again, wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Join the movement and keep the conversation going at deconstructingtherapy.com. And follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at Deconstructing Therapy. If you found value in today's episode, please subscribe and rate us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you are able to and would like to help sustain the podcast, you can find us at buymeacoffee.com/deconstructingtherapy to show your support. Thank you for listening.